Welcome to the Coherence Times, where we will be diving into the science and the story of quantum computing. I am your host, Ryan Mandelbaum. Every other week, I will be sitting down with researchers, technologists, and thought leaders to unravel the incredible challenges and breakthroughs shaping this generational technology. So, whether you are a tech enthusiast, an industry leader, or just someone who's curious about how quantum computing might change the world, you've come to the right place. So together, we will demystify the concepts, bust the myths, and explore not just how quantum computing works, but how it can work for you. How do you actually build a quantum computer? Today, I will be joined by Oliver Dial, the CTO of IBM Quantum and an IBM fellow, who will be taking us from the basics of how a quantum computer works all the way to the latest technology and what it will take to realize a quantum computer at scale. Hello, Oliver, and thank you for joining. First questions first is just, how did you end up in your role at IBM?
Well, I mean, I got involved in quantum computing back when I was a student. And at the time, I was not interested in quantum computing. I didn't understand it. I couldn't see how anyone could get it to work. But I was really interested as a physicist in these devices called quantum dots, which are basically little boxes that you can put exactly one electron in them, and you can do experiments on them. You can kind of torture that electron. And it turned out that some of the groups that were nearby were doing early experiments in how you could use quantum dots inside of quantum computers. And so I really got involved in this entire enterprise from the hardware side up, first interested in how you make these quantum dots, and then beginning to learn how you could build these into quantum computers, and then finally understanding what it's all about and getting really, really excited about it.
What's exciting about an electron torture device?
Well, at the time, what we really cared about was if you take two electrons and you put them together, it turns out that they have a magnetic field, just like a bar magnet, and those magnetic fields have to point in opposite directions. And so this will sound so boring. We were doing experiments where we took the electrons, so we made them point in opposite directions, and we'd pull them apart a little bit, and we'd see how long the electrons would stay pointed in opposite directions again, because if they flipped around, pointing in the same direction, you couldn't put them back in the same box anymore. And so we were literally just doing experiments in packing and unpacking electrons.
Well, I am intrigued, and we should do an entire episode on quantum dots and have you back. I know a lot of people are excited about quantum computing, but before I think we can explain what quantum computing really is, maybe we need to understand what a computer is. So why don't you explain to me first just what a computer is?
Well, a computer is really, at the end of the day, just a big machine for doing arithmetic on numbers. And you can give it a pre-programmed set of steps that it's going to do a series of arithmetic operations on a set of numbers. And I know that sounds super boring, but when you realize that you can represent pictures, when you can represent music, you can represent kind of a video of a cat going around on a vacuum cleaner, all these things as strings of numbers, you begin to get an appreciation for the sorts of things that you can manipulate and do and create with computers. And that's kind of why they become such a big part of our everyday life.
Computer is just a math machine. Then how do you, isn't a quantum computer just a math machine? How are the two different?
Well, it's actually, quantum computer is also just a math machine. It just does a little bit different kind of math. You know, part of the reason why math machines are so interesting is a lot of the world around us can get described by math. I can describe how a ball flies through the air or how a plane flies through the air. Gosh, the air shows up a lot in my explanation here. Or like, you know, how I want to optimize how trains go through a train yard. And that's why when I need to design an airplane or simulate a ball flying or optimize a route, like a computer is a great thing to do. But it turns out that if I want to simulate something really tiny, if I want to simulate something where the laws of quantum mechanics are important, like an atom or a chemical or anything like that, the type of math that our normal computers use is really inefficient and you just can't simulate it well. And that's really important to us because we want to be able to simulate those things because they're so important for materials and for drugs and for all these other things. And so a quantum computer uses the same kinds of math that those little subatomic particles use to do its computation, and that lets it simulate and describe those things efficiently.
If I remember correctly, you explained this to me once as a quantum a regular computer, like the one that you're listening to the podcast on, is kind of like a bunch of on-off switches that are in a line. Like if one on-off switch is one part of the line can tell the ones later on in the line what to do. And then that's kind of all the math that you can do can be represented just in a series of that. But then quantum computer is different, right? Like it's as if you have like access to a whole pile of on-off switches in a big circle that can do whatever they want.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So a lot of computers represent those numbers as ones and zeros because it's really simple to make electronic circuits that manipulate ones and zeros. The neat thing about quantum mechanics is you can have things that aren't just one or zero, but are someplace in between. They can be sort of 90% one, 10% zero, 30% one, 70% zero. And so all those extra options that these switches can have. So now instead of just being on-off switches, they're sort of more like a joystick where it can point in all kinds of different directions, up, down, side, or forward. The number of positions that these switches can be in is much larger, and it lets you do a much more complicated calculation.
So the end of the day is we need to, there's something innate about the hardware of these things that lets us not do that sort of fun joystick math on a classical supercomputer even, right?
Yep. Yeah. The rules that let you make these kinds of joystick math things happen. Can we use that phrase forever now, joystick math?
Sure.
The rules that let that happen only really apply to really tiny things that are very well isolated. In fact, to have these rules apply, it has to be something that's been isolated from the rest of the world so that you couldn't even in principle know what the number was.
I see. So, and then from my understanding, this is how atoms interact with each other, right? So basically, we need to figure out how to build a computer that can control the properties of an atom, right? And then like store information on, you know, like an atom, I don't know, has electrons that can be different positions around the atom. So you could say if it's here, then it's equals 5, and it's here, then it equals -6 or something.
Exactly. But atoms are sometimes a little bit inconvenient to work with. They're easy to lose, for example. And so a lot of the time, instead of using individual atoms, we'll use individual electrons, like I was doing when I was a student. Or in the computers that we make at IBM, we use individual little packets of electrical energy.
Cool. So what does that actually look like then? Like, what does a computer look like compared to what a quantum computer looks like?
Well, I mean, if you took it apart and looked inside, that most classical computers that you use are made of microchips. And those have semiconductors inside of them that you can make little valves that can turn on and off electrical currents that you can use to represent ones and zeros. And you can use those valves to control each other. To build those, we use some of the most advanced manufacturing technology that man has ever made, because we want to be able to pack a lot of those valves into a chip. And you actually build those up layer by layer by layer in a semiconductor manufacturing plant. Some of the layers will be semiconductors to make the valves. Some of them will be metals to move the currents around. And some of them will be wiring to take the signals out of the chip to go to things like the monitor, to go to the speaker, so that you can see your cat at the end of the day. So that's kind of what a conventional computer looks like. And it's kind of hard to imagine that, you know, when we look at the chips in your computers, they have billions of transistors inside of them. And so this manufacturing technology lets you make things that are way more complicated than we ever could, you know, by hand or with a drill press or anything where you have to build it one by one. It's the pinnacle of mass production.
So in this instance, this chip thing, it's literally like the on-off switch analogy is, you're saying valve, but you just mean like a thing that can open and close, that can control the thing ahead of it, right?
Yeah. And the word that we're trying to avoid saying is transistor is what we're building on the chips. But it really is just a valve for turning on and off electricity that's electrically controlled. So you have many of those inside of your computer. Some of them store the numbers, store data. Some of them manipulate the data, the microprocessor. And some of them are responsible for doing things like moving it out to your screen or getting it in from your keyboard.
So now that we all can go ahead and build our own computer chips in our backyard, what is the, so now a quantum computer, if we're, I need to understand what we're actually controlling here and how that looks to somebody. Because I think a lot of people hear quantum computer and they probably still are thinking like test tubes and large hadron colliders and stuff like that. But it doesn't look anything like that.
Yeah. So there's lots of different types of quantum computers. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the ones we built here because they're the ones I know the best. And the kind of neat thing about the ones that we build here is they're built with the same tools that you use to build the computer chips inside of your laptop. And that gives us a lot of advantages in trying to make these things because it's stuff that we kind of already know how to do. The difference between what's inside of your laptop and the ones that we make is the quantum computers that we build here, we need to be able to manipulate these sort of individual, smallest possible packets of electrical energy. And so instead of using transistors, we need to use a different set of tools to do that. Transistors just lose too much energy for us to possibly use them and still be able to use them to manipulate these tiny packets of energy. We would just lose them. they would dissipate away. So specifically in the quantum computers that we make, we use, instead of the metals and the semiconductors you would find in your normal chip, we use something called superconductors. And those are these absolutely amazing materials that let electrical energy flow around with no loss. So it's sort of like, imagine having a car where if you gave it a little bit of a push, it would just roll forever. It's the electrical equivalent of that. And it lets us work with these tiny packets of energy without losing them and do a computation.
So I think then with these superconductors, maybe people don't realize that there is some like equivalent of friction, right, as current flows through a chip. So it flows through a wire at all. So in a classical computer, it's okay, we have this, but you know, we're prepared to have that some sort of heating up. Isn't that why classical computers get hot? Is because there's a lot of electrical current?
Exactly. That's why if you feel your laptop when you're doing something fancy on it and you feel it getting hot, it's because of the energy loss doing this computation. Whereas in an ideal quantum computer, at least as a result of doing the computation, there is no energy loss. Although we still do use a lot of electricity to make it operate.
So why does it need to be, so a superconductor then, it's kind of like this frictionless wire. So what do you need this superconductor for? What is it actually allowing you to do that you can't do classically?
Quantum computers look a little bit different from classical computers in that you sort of do the computation in the same place that you store the data. And we do that in something, you know, we were talking about bits, those switches before. Quantum computer, we also call those qubits. So we need a way to store that tiny bit of electrical energy without ever losing it. And the superconductors give us a way to do that.
Cool. And then by storing such small amounts of electricity, we have the ability to do the math. That's the sort of difference?
That's one part of it. You also have to have a way of manipulating it. So outside of the qubit itself, we have a whole bunch of extra wires that let us get electrical signals into and out of it that let us take that little piece of electricity and manipulate it. Let us take that joystick and turn it into different directions. And outside of that, we have a whole bunch of classical computers that generate the signals that make that happen. I mean, at the end of the day, your computer that you have in front of you, your laptop, it stores not just the numbers, the data, the picture. It also stores the picture, the program that manipulates that data. It's sort of all bundled together into one piece. For quantum computers, we really have two different parts. We have the quantum computer itself, which stores the data, and we do this quantum calculation on it. But the program is stored in a big classical computer outside of it. And the reason we do it that way is it's really hard for us to make quantum computers. And since the program itself is sort of a classical thing, the easiest and the cheapest way for us to store it is on that classical computer. So it's not so much a standalone computer as it is like a coprocessor for a classical computer to do this weird quantum math.
Okay, so yeah, I think that makes sense. And then this, I'm going to wrap this all up for us in a second, but what does this actually look like?
Well, okay, this is kind of the thing that blows my mind the most when I walk into the lab and look at these chips, that the qubits that we make are so big that you can see them with your naked eye. Like, if you pick up one of these chips, you can see two little squares on it that are maybe as big as like the tip of your pen. And those squares store the electrical energy that we're talking about. It's one microwave photon if you want to get really serious. And so it's sort of an amazing piece of science that you can have something that's that big that still obeys the rules of quantum mechanics. It's a really surprising thing to me every time I see this. Our chips have many qubits, and so it looks like a regular array of those little rectangles, and you can see wires going between them for us to be able to do the calculation with.
So at the very core is something that looks like a microchip. Like, we got this microchip, except when you look, it's not like a perfectly smooth mirror surface like it looks like on a classical computer because the transistors are so small. Mm-hmm. But on a quantum computer, it's like you're looking at this regular microchip, but then you kind of squint your eyes and look really closely and you see the individual qubits as these rectangles on the chip wired together.
Exactly. And I should say, when I say wired, I don't mean a wire like, you know, what you use to plug your lamp in. I mean a trace of metal on the chip.
Cool. Like when I think of what a integrated circuit, like a microchip, looks like, it's got the little metal things coming out of the sides. You got that for a quantum computer too.
Yep.
And now this microchip, and then to just summarize what I'm getting from everything else is that inside each of those boxes is a tiny amount of electricity. The smallest imaginable amount of electricity is in each one. And this is happening on, each of these is happening on a superconducting wire. So we can do it in your quantum math. So you have the ability to do that quantum stuff in each side of those boxes. And then the wires that are coming in from the outside are manipulating each of those little electric charges the way that you manipulate a bit on a regular computer. So you're basically doing exactly the same thing you do on a classical computer, but now instead of doing it with transistors, you're just doing it with these different kinds of systems that are interacting. And now because of that, you get new math that you didn't get access to before.
Exactly. I hope I explained it as clearly as you did.
Everybody who's listening, you're now, we all have quantum PhDs thanks to Oliver. Well, so, and now this is the piece that we've left out, because I think now people are probably thinking, oh, it just looks like my beautiful MacBook, which I know for a fact that it does not look like a MacBook. So it has to be, this is, it has to be in like a refrigerator, right? It has to be cold.
Yeah. So there's two reasons why it has to be in a refrigerator. One is superconductivity only works at low temperatures. There's a lot of research going on in trying to figure out how to make superconductors that work at higher and higher temperatures. You may remember articles a few years back about new types of high temperature superconductors. Even those, though, only work at temperatures of around minus 200 degrees Celsius. So high temperature in this world is really, really cold. The superconductors that we use in our chip are not high temperature superconductors because those turn out to be very hard to work with. We typically use, you know, exotic materials like aluminum or niobium, which a lot of jewelry is made out of. So I was being a little sarcastic when I said exotic. But those don't superconduct until you get to right around absolute zero. Aluminum superconducts at about 1 degree above absolute zero. And the reason is if it's warm, then all the atoms in the material are shaking around, and that's enough to disturb the electrons enough that they can't reach the superconducting state. So that's one reason why we have it be super cold. The other reason why we have it be super cold is I said we needed to have these little teeny tiny packets of electrical energy. If you're at a warm temperature, a high temperature, the heat can actually make electrical energy. It can actually make photons. And so we need to be cold enough that just the temperature of the chip is not making those photons appear. When you put these two constraints together, we operate our computers at a temperature of about 0.02 degrees above absolute zero, which is so much colder than deep space by so many orders of magnitude, it's ridiculous. It's one of the coldest sort of bulk environments that people know how to make.
So let's get colder and colder, 200 degrees below zero Celsius. I'm assuming some of you who are listening are Fahrenheit people. So this is like walk outside, instantly die cold, right?
At 200 degrees Celsius.
Below zero Celsius.
Yeah, sorry. I'm used to working in Kelvin at work, so working in Celsius is a little bit of a stretch for me already. At that temperature, almost everything that is in air becomes a liquid. And so the nitrogen, the oxygen, pretty much everything except the hydrogen turns into a liquid. So if you walked outside in that, you would be swimming before you froze.
Sounds like paradise.
It's actually kind of fun because it means if you open up one of our computers too quickly, you'll actually see air condensing on the side of it and dripping off, which is a really weird experience.
That's I can't imagine that's good for the computer.
Yeah, we try not to do that.
Okay, so this is the part that I sometimes struggle with is that, okay, so we're at temperatures where, like, you know, the difference between zero Celsius and one Celsius is, you know, I can understand that, right? And for Fahrenheit, that's like the difference between zero and two Fahrenheit. You know, it's like these are temperature jumps that make sense. But the difference between absolute zero and 1 degree above absolute zero, because of the way temperature works, this is actually like an enormous difference, right?
Mm-hmm. The way I like to think about it is absolute zero really is a special number. It's like where everything stops. And so the difference between like 1 and 10 degrees above absolute zero is a factor of 10 in how much motion there is. So if you wanted to talk about the equivalent thing from room temperature, you'd be talking about the difference between 300 Kelvin, about 22 Celsius, the room you're in, and 3000, which would be like standing inside of an incandescent light bulb. You know, a temperature way hotter than your oven where most metals other than tungsten would have melted. So, you know, if you look at the ratios of these temperatures, you start to get a feeling for how big these differences are. It's like if you have $100, you know, going to $101 does not seem like a big deal. If you have one penny in your pocket, going to $1, 1 cent, that is really important.
Yeah, but I think this is good because maybe it's like when we understand temperature is just hot and cold, we're sort of missing something, because what temperature is actually describing is how fast stuff is moving, like particles are moving, right? And so when you're thinking about it that way, and you need to make a place where the particles are essentially moving as little as possible, then suddenly it's a big deal if it's 10 times more.
Exactly.
You said that this is A, for the superconductor to work, and then B, for keeping these photons out. So can you tell me a bit more about, like, what the disturbance is? What's the issue? Why is it that we need to keep the noise out of this system?
Well, remember, one of the things that we had to have happen for the rules of quantum mechanics to work, for quantum math to be what matters for the system, is that you can't look at it. It's this weird thing where if you're in one of these quantum mechanical states, you know, where the joystick's not pointing just up or down, if you look at it, you snap it back into a classical state. And it's not just a matter of you or me looking at it. It's a matter of, in principle, if anything in the world can find out what those particular qubits are doing, that breaks up the computation. It destroys it. So if we have a whole bunch of light leaking in from the room that can interact with our qubits and tell us what they're doing, that keeps it from being a quantum computer. And so to get that to not happen, we actually build layer after layer after layer of shielding of these. So we're trying to create sort of the coldest, darkest, most isolated environment that you can imagine for these devices to operate in.
And then, so we're basically creating like artificial atoms, right?
That's a great way of thinking about it, yeah.
But now this is interesting. So if you're making these things that can only compute when you're not looking at them, then how do you compute with them if you can't look at them?
Well, so the first rule of any kind of quantum computation is, you and I, we work in a classical world. And so the information that goes into my computer has to be classical. So I do that by taking these qubits and using my wires to set them up in some states. And the information at the end also has to be classical again. And I do that by sending some extra energy into the computer only at the end of the calculation to deliberately see what these qubits are doing. Right. So I create sort of a backdoor for myself to peek in at the end.
I see. So it's all about the instructions that you're sending into this. So we go back to the sort of egg crate of electrons, for lack of a better analogy, and trying to figure, you know, but the egg crate's closed. So you send some stuff in, stuff comes out, but whatever happens inside, you know, that's up to the computer to decide.
Exactly. Exactly. And then at the end of the day, I have to have a way to open the lid and look at what I ended up with.
And so these wires that you're probing this chip with, they're not sending regular electricity in, right?
So our chips, well, I mean, what's regular electricity exactly? Our chips use what are called microwaves. And so it's the same types of signals that, for example, your cell phone uses to communicate with the cell phone towers that are far away from you. And the reason why we do that, there's a couple of reasons. One is it's pretty easy to get electronics that work in microwave frequency ranges because people use them a lot. It's easily accessible. We also want the frequency to be high enough that we get away from noise, that there's all kinds of noise into the world, and a lot of it is concentrated at low frequencies. We want to get up to a high enough frequency that it's easier to deal with. As a specific example, you've probably noticed in your kitchen or someplace that if you get something really hot, it glows. And the hotter you get it, the kind of bluer the glow is. Like if something's cold, it's kind of red. As it gets hotter, it gets kind of bluish and so on. Maybe you haven't noticed that.
I've set some stuff on fire in my life.
Yeah, yeah. You could do this without setting it on fire if you're careful, but it's less fun. So the same thing's true at super low temperatures, that everything glows. It's just the frequency gets lower and lower. Like you and I are glowing in infrared. That's why some types of night vision cameras can work. Yes, you're absolutely glowing, Ryan. So as you get colder and colder, you glow at lower and lower frequencies. And so our devices are down at 0.02 degrees above absolute zero, are actually glowing at a few hundred megahertz, so a few hundred million cycles per second. And that's why it's also important for our devices to work up at these microwave frequencies of about 5 gigahertz, about 1,000 times faster, to get away from that background glow.
So we have to also, in this whole equation, figure out how to see the glow that we want while cutting out the glow we don't want.
I think maybe we're getting to overuse the word glow here, but yeah, absolutely. And so to do that, we use some of the most sensitive amplifiers that people have ever figured out how to make signals bigger and bigger and bigger.
So all the stuff that's happening on this little egg crate with the metal wires that we've just done with the thought experiment. Like, what comes in, well, we can put whatever we want in there, but what comes out is, like, really, really, it's very sensitive. Like, we mm-hmm. have to take a lot of effort to even just figure out what it's spitting out for us as well.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to sort of the night vision analogy, like, if you looked at this with your eye and you could somehow see these frequencies, you would never, ever see it. You need some really great image amplifying camera to make it happen.
All right, so we've been spending a lot of this time talking about the sort of intricacies of what's going on in the quantum chip itself, and we've established that it's basically a really wacky computer chip with a lot of differences. But I think that when somebody thinks of a quantum computer, they don't actually think of this computer chip, but they think about a beautiful golden chandelier and a giant, sometimes a refrigerator, or if they know what that is, or a canister or something. So can you get into, like, the stuff that's a bit more than just the chip? Like, what else? Why is it that a quantum computer, we're saying it's a chip, but it actually looks like a chandelier?
Well, I mean, the chip is sort of the smallest part of this entire thing. That, as I said before, the quantum computer is really controlled by a classical computer outside of it, because it's the cheapest and the most efficient way for us to make it. The classical computer does not want to be at 0.02 degrees above absolute zero. It wouldn't work. And so we need to have a way to somehow connect this chip that is extremely cold to the computer that controls it, that's out here at room temperature. Now, at a very basic level, we do that with wires. But those wires conduct heat. And so if you imagine, as far as the quantum computer is concerned, it'd be like the top of your stovetop. It's the hottest thing you could imagine. And so if the wire, you know, is like the grating on your stovetop, if you reach out and touch it, you're going to burn it yourself, even if you're not directly touching the stove. So what we need to do is make these wires really long so that you can hold one of the end of them without burning your hand and have the other hand be this absolutely hot stovetop. So if you look at our quantum computer, you see the chip at the bottom, and then you see people usually call it a chandelier, these cascades of wires going through plate after plate after plate. And what you're seeing is we've stretched those out so that we can have one end of them being at this blazing hot room temperature, as far as the quantum computer is concerned, and the other end be really, really cold and not have ice forming up at the room temperature side and not have heat flowing down these wires, messing up our quantum computer at the bottom side. And they end up looking pretty beautiful because for a variety of reasons, we tend to gold plate everything inside of them. Those wires tend to be nice, shiny silver tubes, and gives you this great chandelier appearance. The reason why we have all these plates, imagine you're holding a thermos full of hot coffee, right? Your thermos, you've got one. Your thermos does a really good job. And the reason is it's got two sheets of metal with some vacuum in between, and that keeps heat from flowing it. What our refrigerators look like isn't just one refrigerator, one thermos, but it's a thermos inside of a thermos inside of a thermos inside of a thermos. And each one is colder than the one outside. And so when you see these plates with the wires going through them, what you're seeing are the edges of these different thermoses as you get colder and colder and colder going down towards the quantum chip.
Okay, so we basically have this, like, progressive cooling thing going on inside of these refrigerators, designed to make sure we're not conducting too much heat from the outside to the very cold thing on the bottom.
Yeah. Like a refrigerator inside of a refrigerator inside of a refrigerator.
Cool, cool. With, like, doors between each one that allow me to grab the progressively colder food in each fridge.
Exactly.
And then what else is there? There's not just wires on that. From my recollection of what those look like.
Yeah, so in addition to wires, we have amplifiers to make signals bigger when they're coming out of the fridge. We have filters to remove noise that we don't want from the signals as they go down from the computer towards the quantum chip. We have a sort of magical device in there called an isolator, which is the weirdest thing you could ever imagine, that electrical signals can go through it one way, but not the other way. So it's like a one-way street for electrical signals. And we use that as part of the tools that we use to protect signals from coming from room temperature back into our chip when we don't want them to. And then, of course, we have the apparatus that does the refrigeration itself, because these things don't just magically get cold on their own. There's something called a dilution refrigerator and a pulse tube cooler that are responsible for cooling these various thermoses as you go down deeper and deeper.
So I have two questions. We'll start with You said the isolator was the weirdest thing I can imagine, but I imagine something really weird. What? I don't want to harp too much on it, but what is weird in this sort of electrical world?
In most of physics, things happen the same if you play the film forward and backwards. Like, if I imagine playing a film of a car driving down a street, I can put that car in reverse and I can drive it backwards down the street just fine. Like, the rules work okay. If I can throw a ball up, the ball can also come down. And so it's very strange for physicists, but maybe normal people aren't confused by this, to have something where things can go one direction but not the other direction. It usually doesn't happen.
Is there like a specific sci-fi thing that has to happen in order to get that one-way street?
It's sort of related to mirrors, actually. Like, if you think about a mirror, the really weird thing about it is if I hold my right hand up, I can see my right hand, but the guy in the mirror is holding his left hand up, right? And so to get things to only happen in one direction, you sort of need to make something where it can only happen clockwise, but not counterclockwise. To get that to happen in these isolators, we use magnetic fields, because magnetic fields also have sort of this, we call it chirality, this handedness to them. You can think of it as the difference between the north and the south pole of a magnet.
I got it. I think I got it. But now the next question is that we have this refrigerator, and one can't simply buy a refrigerator that cools to absolute zero. Presumably, it is difficult. So, how does one get to these, you know, impossibly frigid temperatures required by the quantum computer?
Well, actually, we don't make those ourselves. There are about half a dozen companies that make commercially refrigerators to get down to these temperatures. They cost a little bit more than the one in your kitchen. But you can absolutely buy them. The cooling looks in a lot of ways like the air conditioning in your house. It's just instead of using Freon, or we don't use Freon anymore because that destroys the ozone layer, but instead of using some chemical, we use helium.
What does the helium do?
Helium, this is just a really nice thing about it. It's the last gas to turn solid. It can go to lower temperatures than anything else before it freezes. And so for the higher temperature stages, we just take the helium as a liquid and we boil it, for example. For the lower temperature stages, we actually dissolve one type of helium into another type of helium.
Why does the dissolving make it colder? This is something I have actually always wondered.
So it's the same process as evaporation. I'm saying dissolving, but you could imagine I have a liquid and there's actually a phase boundary. So it's like oil and water. And the denser liquid is actually evaporating. Less dense liquid actually is actually evaporating into the denser liquid. And just like when something evaporates off of your skin, it cools you down a little bit. When this helium-3 evaporates into the helium-4, it also cools it down a little bit.
So the quantum computer is sweating, and so there's helium-4 is the air, and helium-3 is my sweat, and it takes with it the hot.
Yes, exactly. It's just the most expensive sweat you could ever imagine.
So now I think that I don't want to harp 100% on this, but I wanted to end with one other thing, which is that I also know that it's not just the chandelier, that there's actually stuff outside of the quantum computer too, right? So are there any considerations that go into where what you're putting outside of the quantum computer and the classical computers and what it actually is all going to look like wrapped up together?
Yeah, so to control it, we need to put microwaves in and get microwaves out. And we have a whole bunch of electrical equipment that looks a lot like the radio in your cell phone. It's just, again, instead of talking to a cell phone tower, it talks to the qubits. It's a little bit more specialized because we need these signals to be very, very precise to get the computation to work. And there's a lot of them because we need one of these little radios for every qubit that we have. The other thing we've been playing with a lot lately, though, that's really fun is what happens if you take a quantum computer and a supercomputer and you use them together. Because at the end of the day, you usually have a problem where the quantum math isn't everything, that there's also a lot of classical math. And so it really seems natural to explore finding ways of dividing up the problem into the quantum part and the classical part. And we don't really know the details of how to do this perfectly yet, but it's a really fun research area.
In such a world, the quantum computer might sit next to a classical computer that's tasked with doing some of that stuff, right?
Exactly.
If I'm not mistaken, there's also just classical computer stuff that's required to run the quantum computer.
Yeah, the classical computer holds the program for the quantum computer. And in fact, if you use one of our quantum computers, you can do it over the internet from your laptop. And what you're really doing is sending a program to a classical computer in our building that lives right next to the quantum computer that controls it and gives you the answers back.
One final question before I move on to my next exciting topic I want to talk about is just what is the manufacturing stuff, right? Like this can that it's in. I mean, you have to, there's so many different weird materials that you need to incorporate in order to make it both able to be really cold, not vibrate at all. Like it seems like there's a lot of cool, weird stuff that goes into this thing, right? Or is it mainly conventional stuff?
It's a mix. For a lot of the pieces, it's the kind of thing that you can make at a machine shop, like these cans. They're just made out of copper. They're big copper cans. For a lot of the electronics, they are made the same way that you would make any other piece of electronics, like our control hardware is made by the same sorts of factories that also make your cell phone or make a Walkman if you still have one of those. In some instances, we have to do something a little bit weird, like we have to ask them to add a material that they wouldn't normally use or change the design a little bit so that it can cool down to low temperatures without breaking. But a lot of it, as far as electronics go, is fairly standard. That having been said, almost every piece is custom. This isn't something that you can just go on Amazon.com and buy. That we have to design it, and we send it to these factories that make electronics, and they send it back to us to build these systems with. One of the things that's really exciting that's going on right now is over the next 5 or 6 years, we think our systems are going to get a lot bigger. That right now we build systems of sort of 100 to 1,000 qubits. We think that by the end of this decade, we're going to be making things that are kind of 10,000 to 100,000 qubits. And so that means right now we can be a little bit artisanal, that we can sort of have, you know, okay, you polish this and you have a really skilled person assemble it. And, you know, some guy has to take some dental floss and tie these wires down. To get to these 100,000 qubit numbers, we're really going to have to be moving a little bit less artisanal, a little bit less made by hand to more of a manufacturing environment. And that's a really kind of exciting set of things to be learning how to do.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue because this is my next, this is what I wanted to talk about was, yeah, I mean, the way that we've sort of described this system is rather bespoke. But how do you expect this technology to scale and mature? Like what do you actually have to do in order to get it into that more just plug and play, make it bigger thing?
Well, I think it's going to be a long time before you have a quantum computer. Yeah, sorry. At least not in your physical possession. Yeah. I mean, do you really want to maintain these refrigerators and do all this weird stuff? But that's true of a lot of the computing that we use today. Like when you use your AI chatbot, you're actually using this kind of highly advanced AI accelerator that's sitting in a data center someplace that's water cooled, that has all kinds of fancy electronics around it. And it just doesn't matter to you because you're accessing it over the internet. Like somebody else is worrying about the details of keeping this highly complex machine working. And I think at least for the indefinite future, that's also going to be the way that people are making use of quantum computers. That if we do our job right, it's going to make things better for you, and you will never even realize that it's a quantum computer making that happen for you. That in particular, you know, optimization problems that you want to solve, the Amazon driver will get a little bit faster to your house. We'll be able to make better materials so that you'll have, you know, better solar energy, better catalysis, better fuels. And you'll never realize that a quantum computer was even involved in any of these things. So I think it's going to be subtle at first, but the cumulative impact could be huge.
Cool. So I'm not going to notice that, but I might notice that a quantum data center is being built across the street.
You might. It'll use a lot less electricity than the AI data center getting sent down the built down the block, though, which is kind of a nice thing.
Well, what do you have to do to build, you know, these? I mean, it just looks like building a data center, right? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is that just based on what you've described, like, how do you go from that, which let's say 100 qubits to in this kind of big metal canister? And now that times 100, if you want a million of those, well, then you need 10,000 times 100, right? Is that math?
Yeah, so okay, I hope we yes. don't need okay. a million. That would be really hard. Look, our plan for getting there at first is to build the system in a way that we describe as modular, that we don't want to try to build a 100,000 qubit computer. It would be really too hard for us to do. what we're going to do is design and build about a 1,000-qubit computer, but we're going to make it so that they can be connected together. So if we can design and build a 1,000-qubit computer and we can connect 10 of those together, we'll have a 10,000-qubit computer. That's about what we're planning on doing in 2029. And so what it ends up looking like is right now, you know, we have this chandelier, this beautiful, you know, wiry thing, is it's going to be a series of those connected together to build these larger systems. As far as the data center goes, it gets a little bit specialized. Right now, all the cooling is done individually. Each one of the quantum computers that we put into a data center has its completely own independent refrigeration system. As these systems get bigger, that's going to get impractical. We're actually going to pull the refrigeration system out. So it'll be a little bit more like your house, where the air conditioner sits outside of it to cool you down inside of it. So the technologies will change a little bit, but not dramatically.
So like I would like walk into a room that was 0 degrees Celsius, absolute zero?
Not that big. That we still want to keep the area that we're cooling as small as possible. Energy efficiency is a big concern when we're designing and building these systems. But it'd be more like a walk-in freezer that you can't walk into.
Okay, we've got this this quantum data center, which I'm starting to visualize together, a bunch of chandeliers and millions of qubits. And now, is there a way to continue the sort of miniaturization? I mean, just thinking the fact that it was crazy to me to hear that you can actually see the qubits when in my head, you know, you can't see a transistor. So is there a way to miniaturize in that area as well?
We hope to. That, you know, in the same way that transistors over many, many decades have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller to where now, you know, people are talking about 2-nanometer transistors, which is just crazy. That's like 20 atoms. We do think the qubits are going to get smaller, but it's going to be slow. The reason why we make them so big today isn't that we like to see them. It's that they work better if we make them big. That it turns out that if we take that tiny bit of electrical energy and we spread it out over more space, it's easier to protect it. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but if you think about it as our qubits live on the surface of the chip, that's why you can see them. There's always some dirt up there, right? Some stuff that we didn't intend to be on the top of the chip. Maybe it's a little bit of water, a little bit of oxide, who knows? If we make the qubit bigger, more of the electrical energy actually goes down into the chip or up out into the air above the chip and stays away from the dirt, and they work better. So as we learn how to make things cleaner, as we learn how to make these materials purer, we should be able to make the qubits smaller and keep the same performance. But it's a really hard set of problems to solve.
And I hope you solve them. And I have this one last question for you before I let you go. And this is the question that I'm hoping to ask all of my guests, which is just, what do you hope a world with quantum computing will look like?
You know, I think a lot of the reason why mankind can do the things that we can do is we can simulate the world around us. We can optimize it. We can figure out how to build these beautiful things because we can predict what will happen before we do something. And that's just so important, because if you can make that prediction, then you can do the best thing the first time, or at least a very good thing the first time. And so to me, the most exciting thing about quantum computers is that it will open up these entire new areas where we're going to be able to make predictions. We're going to be able to say what's going to happen if we build this chemical the first time before we've actually built it. We'll be able to try drugs much more quickly. We'll be able to develop new materials much more quickly. Maybe we'll even get room temperature superconductors if we can get rid of these refrigerators. And so to me, the most exciting thing about the world with quantum computers is this ability to make, to optimize, and to predict better than we ever could before.
And then the last question is just, if you want them to, is there a way that people can follow along with the work that you're doing or the work that IBM Quantum is doing or learn more about quantum hardware in general?
Well, I mean, the first thing is if you're interested in using quantum computers, I mean, we make 10 minutes of time of our systems available for free to anyone every month. And so you can just go and play with these things. If you want to learn more about it, we have a whole bunch of really pretty interesting and accessible blogs. If you want to get really serious about it, the people that I know that work in this field, they come from a lot of backgrounds, but they mostly studied physics, they studied mathematics, they studied computer science, they studied electrical engineering. Any of those things are a great way to get involved with this field much more deeply.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Oliver. This was really fun. And I will be seeing you, I'm sure. That's it for this episode of the Coherence Times. If you enjoyed the conversation, please be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and share it with somebody who's curious about quantum. You can find us at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube via the IBM Research Channel. And for more episodes, resources, and deep dives, please visit us at ibm.com/think/podcasts. I'm Ryan Mandelbaum. Thank you for tuning in. And remember, the quantum future isn't just coming, we're building it right now.